The Plumley Pod, episode 74.
Prepare to lift the lid on all things education, not indoctrination. Your voice of reason for home education, The Plumley Pod.
Hello and welcome to the Plumley Pod. I'm your host, Sarah Plumley, and today's very special guest is Dr. E. Michael Jones, the editor of Culture Wars magazine, prolific writer, author of an avalanche of fantastic books. Good morning, Dr. Jones, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for that kind introduction.
I've been doing an awful lot of reading, and I am absolutely stunned at my new understanding of history. I was supposedly very good at history. I did well at school, at university, but a lot of it never really fully made sense to me until I started listening to your live streams and then at reading your books. Recently, you've reviewed what I would describe as quite an obscure book. Is it true that Satanism is the hidden grammar of the United States? And if so, how did it get there?
The answer is yes. It got there by something that started in England. It's called the Reformation. Now, everybody's heard this term. No one knows what it is. The Reformation was a looting operation that masqueraded as a religious event. There is no theological justification whatsoever for the Reformation in England. None whatsoever. It was basically aristocrats lusting after church property. They got their break when Henry VIII made his break. And the man who put it in a nutshell was R.H. Tawney, Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, where he said the upstart aristocracy had their teeth in the carcass and they weren't going to be whipped off by a sermon. So the image is of dogs basically devouring a carcass. The dogs were the aristocrats in England and the carcass was the Catholic Church property in England. If you want the full story, the best story is William Cobbett's History of the Reformation in England and Ireland. Great writer, great personality, something like George Galloway of the 19th century. But anyway, so those people started fighting almost immediately. Those people, meaning the people who stole the property. Every successful revolution leads to a civil war. And England is no exception. The civil war broke out in the 1640s. And the people who seized power were known as Puritans. And the number three signer of the death warrant of the king was a Puritan by the name of John Milton, who became famous as a poet. And you probably read his poetry in school. He is the man who wrote the Protestant epic. And the Protestant epic is known as Paradise Lost. And as every good romantic knows, the hero of Paradise Lost is Satan. And so those folk came over here. They weren't the first people over here, but they came over here. So you had a situation where you had Catholic France to the north, Catholic New France, called Canada, Catholic Spain, New Spain to the south, that was known as Mexico. And in the middle, it's up for grabs. And the Puritans arrived in Massachusetts Bay in 1630, and they brought with them their insane religion. The English, after the Restoration, the English hatred of Puritanism was so great that they actually dug up Cromwell's body and hanged the corpse, and his head popped off at that point, and they've never found it since that time. But that thing that was repudiated in England took root here in a unique situation for basically the human race. This is the New World. You have people coming from the Old World to the New World. It's a forest. That's it. It's big forest. These trees go on forever. And these Englishmen show up, and it's a matter of live or die because the climate in Massachusetts is extreme in the winter. And you have two issues here. You got existence, which is the woods. You got essence, which is the Bible, according to Calvin. And these are the only things you have to put together to create a civilization. So how is that going to work out? Well, you have to understand the hidden grammar of Protestantism, which is Satanism, to understand how that's going to work out. And basically, what happened is something similar to what is happening right now in Gaza, because the Puritans are Judaizers. And so what the Puritans did was that they said the Indians were Amalek, and they set out on a program of ethnic cleansing. very similar to what the Jews are doing today. Jews always have the same idea. The Judaizers always want to call themselves God's chosen people. As soon as you say that, anybody who disagrees with you is Amalek and deserves to be destroyed. And so that's how it got started. It's all in Satan's speech at the beginning of Paradise Lost. This whole idea of an intellectual country, the mind is its own place, and it can make heaven out of hell or hell out of heaven. And if that's the case, it's better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. This is the essence of Protestantism. It's not scripture. Scripture was created by the Catholic Church. It's not any of those things. This is the essence, and this is the essence of America, and it's been that way to this day. And I think the man who really understood this in a deep way is Nathaniel Hawthorne. He is a genius. He is the greatest writer that America has ever produced. And I say that not just because I wrote my dissertation on him 50 years ago, but because I read The Scarlet Letter yesterday, and I was stunned by the artistic power of this book, but also by the psychological insight into the American character that they had. So let's get back to the Reformation. One of the principles of the Reformation is sola gratia. There's sola scriptura, by scripture alone, sola fide, by faith alone, and sola gratia, by grace alone. Let's just concentrate on the last one. That's one of the principles, and the reformers announce it at the very moment that they cut the population of England off from the source of grace that Jesus Christ had provided for him, which is the sacraments of the Catholic Church. So you do this, and it has incredible psychological consequences, especially when you leave England. So you're in England, they all function according to custom. The great philosopher of this was Edmund Burke, who just said basically, look, don't talk to me about principles. Anytime you talk to an Englishman about metaphysical principles, he gets really upset and changes the subject because all they believe in is custom. So this is when, like, Mary Wollstonecraft says, you want to go back to tradition? Do you want to go back to the time when Englishmen worshiped bread as God? And Burke, of course, says, no, he doesn't want to do that. So it's custom. Well, you're cut off from custom in the New World. You have the woods and you have the Bible and you've got your human nature, and human nature cut off from grace is going to be led into sin. We're all led into sin, even with grace. But if you cut them off from grace, you're going to be led into sin in a world where you can't confess it, because in order to be a member of the Puritan Church, you have to be a saint. You have to be the visible elect on earth. And so this creates incredible psychological pressure.
It's a high bar, isn't it? An extreme bar.
It is humanly impossible, and America is proof of that. So what happens is you have this psychological pressure builds till the tectonic plates shift, and they go crazy. And so the first example of this is the Salem witch trials, where it's a mass hysteria, it's a moral panic, 20 people have to die because of it. The only one who ever understood this, I think, was Nathaniel Hawthorne. He is the only one who understood and looked into the psychological pressure that it gets exerted on the soul when you're told that you're a saint, and now you know you committed adultery. Now, how are you going to resolve that dilemma? How are you going to do it?
That's a key part of the plot for Arthur Miller's The Crucible, isn't it? The protagonist, Proctor, he is guilty because he's possibly had relations that he shouldn't have had with Abigail Williams. And he lives in this puritanical culture. It's like the subplot through Miller's Crucible. It's absolutely terrifying, obviously the horrifying conclusion to that play. Could you tell us about how capitalism fits into all of this? Because this is not a small part of this Protestantism, Satanism, is it? Tell us about the sort of material side of this.
Well, as I said, the Reformation was a looting operation. And the one man who understood that was Karl Marx. And he said capitalism began with theft. He's talking about the theft of the property of the Catholic Church. So, okay, that's the historical rationale behind it. But what is capitalism? Again, we have to have a definition here, because otherwise you'll end up like Protestantism. Nobody knows what it is. Capitalism is state-sponsored usury. And this was the crisis in England for centuries, because basically, if you have a Catholic monarch, He understands that usury is a sin, and he understands usurious contracts are not valid. They're not valid contracts. It's like your contract with the mafia to rub out your next door neighbor is not a valid contract because it's a criminal activity. And so you couldn't count on Catholic monarchs to enforce usurious contracts. And this was the underlying cause, because basically every monarch had to borrow money. And as soon as they borrowed money, they went into debt. So if you're talking about something relatively contemporaneous, you have a relatively benign situation where the Fugger family are the bankers for the Habsburgs. And the first loan is 1493, something like that, right around the time that Columbus discovers America. And the Fuggers bragged that they never charged more than 6%. The Jew, on the average, charged 43 1/3%. Now, obviously, if you're lending to the king, you know, you're going to cut it down a little bit, but maybe 20%. That's still a lot. Okay, so at this point, the Habsburgs came into possession of every gold and silver mine in the New World. And the money just poured into Spain, in spite of the fact of Sir Francis Drake and his buddies, the famous heroes, English heroes, the pirates.
It's just shameful.
The only guy who gets this guy, I think he's buried in Westminster Abbey.
Occupation pirates.
This is funny because it finally dawned on the English at the time of Gilbert and Sullivan when they wrote The Pirates of Penzance. And the famous song is The Pirate King in The Pirates of Penzance, you know, where he basically, if you're going to steal something in England, steal about $1 billion worth of Spanish gold. Don't steal, if you steal a spoon, they'll hang you. But if you steal all that gold, they'll make you a knight and they'll bury you in Westminster Abbey.
To this very day.
To this very day. They'll probably even bury Boris Johnson there, one of the criminals. Anyway, I don't want to get into bad-mouthing Boris Johnson. God bless him. But anyway, so at this point, the Habsburgs go bankrupt. How do you go bankrupt when you own every single gold? Well, the answer is compound interest or usury. And that is the sets the stage for all of European history after that. I have a book called Barren Metal, which tells the story in detail. So basically, it's the same thing with England. So the Whigs take over 1688. It's called the Glorious Revolution because you couldn't trust that Catholic to enforce usurious contracts. So they had to bring in King Billy the Dutchman, who took over, a Protestant usurper. Shows you how they talk about tradition, but they don't believe in it. They believe in capitalism, state-sponsored usury, and they create the Bank of England at this point. And at this point, Cobbett nails it. He says you divided England between taxpayers and tax eaters. And the tax eaters were the Whig oligarchs who created the bank. And now the money flowed from tax money into the bank and they became incredibly wealthy. But there is a problem here. And the problem is what I just talked about with the Fuggers and the Habsburgs. No floating loan can be repaid after 60 years. It is impossible because of the trajectory of the compound interest, which is an exponential curve. Well, this happened 60 years after the founding of the Bank of England. And it happened, and so Lord Townsend calls in Adam Smith, who's a bright guy who's written a book on economics, and says, what are we going to do? And Smith says, well, we'll tax the colonies because we paid for their fighting the French and Indian War, and so they'll be happy to pay. Well, they weren't happy. And it was the Stamp Act, and that led to the American Revolution, and that led to the separation of America from England. So that's capitalism. I mean, I could go into detail. Presbyterianism was basically capitalism with a kind of holy water sprinkled on it. It was basically British imperialism, the English language, capitalism, being spread among barbaric people like the French in Canada, who happened to be Catholic, by the way, and happened to be Indians and intermarried and so on and so forth.
It was shocking to me when I read your review of Immanuel Todd's book. I hadn't realized that this is how it has all fitted together from the very beginning, that this theme of the idea, it might sound silly to you, but I don't come from a Catholic background. So the idea of sort of moral economics coming from Catholicism, I have no idea, no comprehension of that whatsoever until I'd read this work. I don't have Barren Metal, but it's on my to-read list next after having read that.
Good. By the way, just to clarify the issue, it's not from Catholicism. Economics is part of moral philosophy.
Yeah.
And Adam Smith was hired to teach moral philosophy when he got the job at Edinburgh. So he began from the proper matrix, and it launched off into English capitalism, which basically became pseudo-physics. Because everybody had to do something. Whatever you're doing, Isaac Newton is the guy who explains everything. And so Adam Smith took gravity and inertia and turned it into self-interest and competition, the same thing, because they're both really love and strife, which is what Isaac Newton got from Empedocles. He was an alchemist. And just to put your English enlightenment in perspective, Isaac Newton and John Locke performed alchemical experiments in Isaac Newton's apartment in Cambridge.
Wow. It's fascinating to me how all of this is so interconnected and interwoven. But is it true that the Catholic Church used to have to referee on financial matters, particularly thinking about the Middle Ages when commerce was starting to really flourish from all of the important ports in Europe? Is that the case, that people who had financial issues would go to the Catholic Church as a kind of referee on those kinds of matters?
There was no separation of church and state during the time of the Holy Roman Empire. And if you're talking about the crucial moment, it came basically when the money economy came into being. Because in the Middle Ages, the serf owed the lord labor. So you had to work a certain number of days a week for the lord. But then when you have the beginning of manufacturing, which begins with in Florence, and Italy, the city-states in Italy, when they start manufacturing cloth. That is the beginning of financial exchange. It's the beginning of double-entry bookkeeping, which came from Venice. Italy was the center of the universe, no matter what. And the guy who understood that clearly was Shakespeare. You could tell the awe with which Italy was held at that time. Italy was like a third-world country that shipped raw wool out. So at this point, when you've got now people working in factories, cloth factories, and they have to pay taxes, and they need money now to pay taxes, and so they have to go to the Jew, because the Jew is the guy who lends you money, and he lends it to you at 43 1/3% interest. And you can pawn your tools just to make sure he gets something if you don't be paid, but then if you pawn your tools, you can't work, so you've got a huge crisis here. And the Catholic Church intervened at this point on the side of the working man, and you had basically the Dominicans and the Franciscans creating something called the Monte di Pietà in Italy, which was the pawn shop for poor people, which charged no more than 5%. And that allowed them to borrow the money they could pay for, you needed to pay taxes, and it eliminated the usury burden from the economy. Now, there's a catch here. Yes, we will build the Monte di Pietà, the Franciscan would say to the prince, but you have to expel the Jew. Because as things stand right now, we're competing against, you're probably doing it yourself, okay? So don't play innocent with me. But basically, the Jew is charging poor people 43 1/3%. That allows him to pay 20% return on investment to all of the people, like the princes and the cardinals and the high officials in the church. And that was the Achilles heel of the church. You had to expel the Jew in order to make the Monte di Pietà work. And they refused to do that because the Jew would invariably come to the prince and say, look, I'll let you have it for 6%. And the prince could not resist low interest rates. So it subverted the whole attempt to bring the economy under Christian control from the beginning.
What about the idea that labor is true value? And let's talk about how that differs between Judaism and Christianity, Catholicism.
Yes, there are two sources of value. One is labor. Labor is the source of all value. Karl Marx said that. John Locke said that. Adam Smith said that. And Pope John Paul II said that. Now, what do they have in common politically? Not much. It's because it's true. It is true. And so Locke said, even the deer in the forest, in order to make use of it, you have to have labor. You have to shoot the deer. You have to dress the deer. You have to cook the deer, and so on and so forth. So everything, labor is the source of all value. The opposite point of view, that's the Catholic point of view. The opposite point of view is the Jewish point of view, and that's represented by Shylock in Merchant of Venice. And Shylock says to Antonio, I'd like to lend you some money. And Antonio says, because I'm your friend. And so Antonio says, well, if you're my friend, you wouldn't lend me money, because if it's breed of baron metal, which is where I got the title of my book, then keep it. Breed of barren metal goes back to Aristotle, who said that money was sterile. Aquinas said, if you put 2 ducats in a drawer and come back 6 weeks later, you still have 2 ducats. So you put 2 mice in the drawer and you'll have lots of mice all over the place because money is sterile. This is exactly what Antonio is throwing in the face of Shylock. And Shylock comes back to him and says, my ducats can copulate faster than Laban's ewes and rams. Well, what's he thinking? No, your ducats don't copulate. What you're talking about is interest, usury. That's what it is. I think that's the greatest play Shakespeare ever wrote, in my humble opinion. It's such a brilliant play, and it gets right to the heart of something that is a crucial issue for Europe and its development. So there are the 2 options. It's either labor or usury, and that's what barren metal's about.
I don't see these options. To me, there is no choice there. It's Hobson's choice. It has to be labor. It has to be. Otherwise, what is the point? What do you do to a man if he has nothing to work for? You don't just work to have a financial well-being. You work for all kinds of reasons. It's good for you. It makes you feel like you've accomplished something, that you're working towards something, that you've achieved something.
Right.
I'm a big pusher of the value of working hard and working well for the sake of it, because you get so much more out of it.
Right.
I cannot understand that as a choice to me. And yet I've been brought up in a very different culture, not realizing that all of these decisions about the economy in my country are being made for me by people who have a radically different view of morality. Well, they don't seem to understand morality, if I can be so bold as to say that.
No, I agree. Well, if you want to know the world we live in is the world created by users. The beginning of it was in England, as always, with Margaret Thatcher. Reagan was kind of an imitation of Margaret Thatcher. I think she believes that ducats can copulate. I think that she was came from that school. And as a result, she privatized the wealth of the English nation. Now, I know it was too much state control after World War II. Socialism was the problem after World War II. I agree with that. But you didn't solve the problem by basically selling it off to rich people who then used it to basically make money the way you make money on a monopoly board. The ruthless dismantling of English manufacturing, followed by the ruthless dismantling of American manufacturing, is one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. Because labor is the source of all value. And a factory is a very efficient or sophisticated way of mobilizing labor. And Henry Ford was the great hero of American labor in that regard because he created the assembly line. I learned this firsthand when I went to Africa. If the one thing that Africans don't know how to do is how to mobilize labor, they never learned it. And the main reason, I think, was polygamy. So I went to Tanzania. I was invited by the Bishop of Musoma to write a biography of Julius Nyerere, the first president of Tanzania, also a Catholic. And yet there's an exchange there. Julius Nyerere's father had 13 wives, and his brother had 8 wives. And so he said to his brother, why do you have so many wives? And he said, well, I need children to run my farms. And Nyerere said, well, why don't you buy a tractor? Now, that epitomizes the tragedy of Africa. The guy that Nyerere idolized was Mao Zedong. He wanted to revolutionize agriculture in Africa. He thought all he needed to do was buy a tractor, and it didn't work because they didn't know how to mobilize labor, and they didn't know because they never did it. Their children were the people who worked for them. So you procreated your labor force. You didn't organize it. And that's true to this day.
So how has this situation with capitalism via Protestantism morphed into Satanism? How do you get from one to the other to the other? Is it all just the same thing all along? How is it manifested? How can we see it? How can we show other people that it started here and it's here we are now?
Well, that's a long story. But I think that who's my favorite villain? Isaac Newton. What did Isaac Newton do? He turned the universe into a machine. All you need is gravity and inertia, and then you get perfect circular motion. And what you do then is exclude divine providence from history when you do that, because you don't need God anymore. All you need is those 2 forces. And that led to the kind of secularization of the universe, and that led to the expulsion of morality from the universe. And given the Puritan mindset, it would lead capitalism into a form of Satanism. I don't like to overuse this word. I try to use it very literally here, which I can do when I'm talking about John Milton and Paradise Lost and with the American Puritans, especially Nathaniel Hawthorne, Ralph Waldo Emerson, they all advert to some type of satanic entity. But I'm saying that what did Blake? Blake was the man who understood that Satan was the hero of Paradise Lost. And he wrote this book where he talked about the satanic mills. It was all the early industrial places in England. It was the first place to really industrialize. And I forget which part. It's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. One of his poems talks about the satanic mills of places like Birmingham.
Jerusalem, and did those feet in ancient times among those dark satanic mills.
Okay.
That pops up in Jerusalem.
Yeah, you folks sing that every New Year's Eve or something like that, don't you?
Yeah, it's sort of a cricket anthem as well for the big sort of cricketing culture that they have. We sometimes get told off because it's racist or something now, but it still persists. It was being used in place of the national anthem at one time. I'm not sure whether it still is or not, before cricket matches in England.
This is a very important because I think he's following directly in the footsteps of Milton. And it was Blake who said that Satan was the hero, but it's transposed now from the 17th century to the 19th century, the early 19th century, and the Industrial Revolution, where you have this power without any type of moral guidance. And that would be satanic. That's what he saw it as, satanic.
Emmanuel Todd could help us out here as well, because I'm with you. I don't like to overuse satanic either. It's difficult because we live in a world where we apparently can't even define man and woman.
Right, right.
So it's very hard, isn't it, to be, even speaking plain English is rather difficult. But he talks about nihilism, doesn't he, a lot?
Yes.
In his book. And that I think that's a helpful way of explaining to particularly younger people what Satanism constitutes or the kind of Satanism that we're trying to talk about.
That's right. Nihilism. That's the closest he comes. I did a book called Logos Rising, which is a history of ultimate reality. And one of the chapters is on Hegel. So he's writing the phenomenology at the same time that Goethe is writing Faust. And he's talking about negation. That is part of the dialectic. If you read Logos Rising, you'll understand how he destroyed the dialectic, basically by importing evil into God. And he got that idea from Luther, who did it in The Enslaved Will. Hegel was a Lutheran theologian at this time. So anyway, you got all these forces coming together. Napoleon's on the march. Hegel's having these meetings with Goethe. Goethe's writing Faust, and I think suddenly he realizes all this talk that Hegel's doing about negation leads him to turn Mephistopheles into Hegel. Hegel is Mephistopheles, and the line of Mephistopheles is, Ich bin der Geist der Stets verneint. I am the spirit of eternal negation. That's, I think, the connection here. That's where the Satanism enters this part, and Verneinung is nihilism. This is the term that Nietzsche made popular because it's the repudiation of all values, and it's the worship of nothing, and there is no such thing as nothing. Everything has being because of God, including Satan, was a creature of God, but the only way he could assert his identity was by turning to nothing, turning toward nihilism. So when you have nihilism, you have the collapse of all values, which is what Nietzsche applauded. And when you have the collapse of all values, that's the form of society, and no one knows how to act, and the result is violence. And that's part of the genius of Todt's article, is he understands how the collapse of these identities has led to violence. So, for example, he talks about the Swedes. Everybody knew the Swedes are neutral, right? As soon as Lutheranism collapses as the form, what do? They join NATO. And then they start fighting against the Ukraine.
Yeah, if you had told me that that was going to happen, I wouldn't have believed you. The Swedes don't fight. They don't do anything.
No, I know. I'm shocked.
Now, stunning. Stunning. It seems to me, and this is a layperson doing the reading here, but it seems to me that Martin Luther and Henry VIII had quite a bit in common. Both of them liked the ladies, perhaps.
Yes.
It might be said. So it's not just a financial problem. There's also the idea of sexual liberation. I once watched a wonderful lecture by Bishop Richard Williamson from many years ago now, where he walks you through how Protestantism, i.e. liberalism, destroyed the West, and particularly with reference to the Catholic Church. And he pits the one against the other. And I had never seen history put together that slickly and in such a easily digestible way before. And it explained a whole pile of things to me that I'd never even considered. I didn't realize, and it sounds silly now, but Catholicism is the original Christianity. It has to be. It's the original. And Protestantism, every other form of Protestantism has come out of that. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but as somebody raised in Protestantism with not really any commitment, there was no one in my family committed to the church, really, apart from my grandmother, perhaps. I had no idea. And it's only looking back at history, you go, wait a minute, this all stems from Luther. And then Calvin after Luther. And then you get Henry VIII, who can't keep it in his pants and he wants to marry whoever he wishes. So he completely destroys all of this, everything that's been accumulated, the knowledge, the wealth from all of those years. And
that's right.
We are not taught that in British classrooms in history. It's not looked at from that perspective at all, at all. It's the Catholic Church was greedy and wicked. And hurrah, Luther comes along to save the day. And now, later, Henry can marry who he wants. He'll break with Rome and it's all going to be fine. And this is the kind of story that we're fed as history. And it's horrifyingly wrong.
It's called Whig history. Have you ever heard that term?
I haven't, no. First time. Makes sense.
Well, there's a man by the name of Butterfield wrote, it's a book you can read. It's called Whig history. Basically, Whig history exists to create the justification for Protestantism and the theft of church property and the building of a usurious empire based on that theft. But you're right. There are basically two sins. The two sins of the foundation of Protestantism are lust and avarice. So lust characterizes the clergy, especially Luther. You're right. He was just like Henry VIII. He had a very difficult time controlling his passions. It wasn't just one. It was all of them. As with Henry VIII, Henry VIII got so fat that they had to use a kind of contraption to get him around because he just couldn't control that passion either. Luther had trouble controlling his eating. He drank too much. He had anger management problems, but the big problem was lust. So he's sitting by himself, and basically the Protestant Reformation in Germany was basically horny monks going out and going to the convent and engaging in women's liberation. They break into the convent. They drag the nuns out. Some of them they had to drag out. Some of them were eager to get out. And then Luther would offer the nun to a bishop if he would come over to the reform side. He offered to this bishop of Mainz. He so wrote him a letter saying, you can have the prettiest nun of the lot if you come over to the English party. So I don't know what you call that in England, but over here we call that a pimp, who is basically offering women to other men for money or financial consideration. Well, this doesn't cast us in a very good light, but that's not the worst part of it. The worst part of it is when you take your vice and you rationalize it and turn it into a religious principle. And that's what Luther did right after he married Katharina von Bora. He wrote De Servo Arbitrio, which is on the enslaved will, and he basically said, no one has free will. You have to obey your passions. You have no choice in the matter because it's God who is doing this. I didn't screw that nun. God made me do it. This had a terrible effect on morality in general. I mean, moral struggle is tough enough under the best of circumstances. Let's say with the Catholic Church and the grace that comes from the sacrament and culture being built to promote these type of things, and then when you cast intellectual doubt on that, you drive people crazy. And I think the first manifestation of this craziness was the witch trials. They are a Protestant phenomenon, and it was the first group hysteria that happened in America because of the Puritans. It was the witchcraft trials.
It seems to me that the two of the key problematic characters in dragging culture under both had issues. They both had agendas entirely of their own. They couldn't keep it together. They gave in to passions of the flesh, both Martin Luther and Henry VIII, these two
right.
huge characters from our history. And they are never put into context, certainly in British classrooms, the way they live their lives. There's not much scrutiny going on there. So we're fed this stuff as though, well, this is fantastic, isn't it? Because now we can marry whoever we want, blah, blah, blah. But hang on a minute. Wait a minute. These two people both had serious personal issues. And these are two of the main characters who have, frankly, led to the destruction of Catholicism, certainly in England. It's in very poor shape, thanks to the Reformation and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, the problem is it wrecked England too.
Yes.
That's the problem, but it took a long time. You could see this repression. I went to Bolton Abbey, and it's obviously a medieval church, and the sign you go in the door says, Mass has been celebrated here since 11 something or other, And then you walk in and there's this brick wall. Wait a minute, what's that brick wall doing there? Well, it's blocking you off from the sanctuary as if to tell you there's some secret behind there. And this was the repression of the truth that distorted the English personality. It distorted it into a kind of messianism. In other words, England is the religion. And then you go to Westminster Abbey and they have pirates buried there and they got Unitarians buried there. All these people are buried there because it's kind of like the national church. And that was what happens when you broke with the unity. You created a national church. You created a church that was all white. Not that they knew they were white, but when they came to Virginia, suddenly it became the source of racism because you had black slaves and you had Scottish slaves for the most part. And in order to separate them, you had to create categories like black and white. That's when the term white came into existence. It's in the Oxford English Dictionary on historical principles. It's in there. If you look it up, white is first used to apply to human beings in a play that was performed in London around 1609, which is around the time of the founding of the Virginia colony.
So we've kind of exported our disease to America. So talk about how us exporting this awful disease of Protestantism, especially the extreme forms of it like Puritanism, how has that led to what we're seeing right now in the United States?
That's a great question. That's what I'm writing this book about right now. How did you end up like this? You have two forces here. You have existence and you have essence. These are two attributes of being. So when you arrive in Massachusetts Bay, you've got the Bible and you've got the woods. And you've got to create a civilization based on your understanding of the Bible and the fact that you've got to live through the winter to survive in the woods. And so what do? You bring paradigms from the Bible. So one of the first sermons was, it's called Errand into the Wilderness, and Massachusetts was called the Wilderness. Where'd they get that term? It's from the gospel, and it's referring to John the Baptist baptizing in Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan River. Well, that's not like Massachusetts. When you do that, then you are the God's chosen people. And when you're God's chosen people, then anyone who opposes you is Amalek. And that was the beginning of this. To this day, let's be honest, it goes to this day. So we are the heirs of the English. We inherited, you're right, it's a disease. We inherited this disease from the English. And then it became changed by the frontier, which is existence, into America. Over the course of the 18th century, the crucial figure in this regard was Daniel Boone. Have you heard of Daniel Boone?
I have, Dr. Jones, no.
Well, he's the most famous frontiersman in America. So Daniel Boone is born in Pennsylvania. He's a Quaker.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Now, Quakers, everybody hates Quakers. Ben Franklin hated Quakers because they're hypocrites, because they want to preserve their property, but they don't want to defend it because they're pacifists. So Daniel Boone is also going to lead people through the Cumberland Gap into Kentucky. Well, guess who's on there? It's Indians, and they don't want you to come here. So what's the Quaker got to do? He's got to pick up a gun. This is America, the Quaker that picked up a gun. And at that point, you have to modify your religion to suit the reality of the situation. And eventually, America became the religion. America is the religion, and that's what leads people like George Bush to talk about liberating Iraq. Anyway, it's something that reads a kind of book-length treatment, but I'm saying that will head you off in the right direction. Because what is the cowboy? We can backstep a little bit to go back to Indiana Jones. There's a paradigm. Go back to Gary Cooper in For Whom the Bell Tolls. Watch that movie. Gary Cooper is the great actor who embodied what it meant to be an American. And in the middle of that movie, the Spaniards, Pablo is saying, so do you kill Republicans? And he said, no, in America, we don't kill Republicans. Well, we kill Republicans. So obviously, it's a pun on the Spanish meaning of the word Republican and so on and so forth. So he's a man on a mission. He's not just some mercenary. He's not a religious figure. He's a combination of all of these things fighting for the new American religion, which is freedom from oppression. It's in Star Trek. It's in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Do you remember Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom? He's a professor. Remember that? He's a professor. He shows up and he liberates all those Indians from slavery. That is how that Puritan ideal a bee on an errand into the wilderness, a city on a hill morphed into American imperialism, which is now running aground in the Ukraine and Israel. Went too far. You went one bridge too far. And that's, so we're in this moment of history. To get back to Tote's book, that's Tote's thesis. The American empire is collapsing because Protestantism has evaporated.
I know this is an exceptionally difficult question, but how would Catholicism have prevented this nihilistic, satanic state of America, this awful war, death, machine of death? How would that have been prevented, do you think?
Yes, it would have been a different world. And so you could go to Lake Michimilimackinac, right on the Straits of Mackinac, the northernmost part of the southern peninsula of Michigan. This was New France. They built this fort there. And there's an official video of the state of Michigan. So state of Michigan says, the beginning, there's a picture of the Catholic priest blessing the marriage between the voyageur and the Indian maiden. So if the Catholics had taken over, there would have been intermarriage instead of ethnic cleansing. And that would have been the most significant event. So then what happens in Michigan? The English conquer, your hero Wolfe conquered Quebec in a stunning military display, took over all of Canada, and now Fort Michimilimackinac is in the hands of the English. The English, this is, I'm not making this up, okay? The English then bring in a Jew who is the head of the trading post. The Jew cheats the Indians. The Indians kick their highlay ball over the post. They, please open the gate. They open the gate and they slaughter everyone inside. And then they say, we are going to be loyal to the King of France. We don't like the King of England. That would have been an entirely different scenario than what we had, which is basically messianic politics leading to war after war after war.
Wow. I wasn't expecting even an attempt. I know that's a horribly ambitious question, but it's worth bearing in mind, isn't it, that if you get the morality right on an individual basis, if you can control your passions, be they for food or women, then perhaps all of these horrific things on a global level would not be happening, because people would have that relationship with God, and they would have that oversight or that assistance from the church. Is that a little too wild, or is that
That's it? Brilliant. It's so simple, isn't it? It's so simple.
I'm a teacher. I simplify things. That's unfortunately what we do. But yeah, on the other hand...
You're a great teacher. You simplified that whole thing. That's exactly the point.
I wish people would realize, you know, how many pages of notes I've read and how many books to kind of be able to do that and not just do it in a lazy way. But that's the essence of it, isn't it?
That was brilliant.
Well, I probably have peaked now, so perhaps I could go on forever, but I know you're an exceptionally busy man. Would you mind telling us, Dr. Jones, where we can find more information? Tell us about Culture Wars magazine and, crucially, where we can buy your books, please.
Yes, the books are at fidelitypress.org. Do not go to Google. Do not go to Amazon. Go to fidelitypress.org to buy all the books I mentioned are all for sale there. Or you can get a more contemporary take on everything if you subscribe to Culture Wars magazine. Comes out every month, and that is at culturewars.com. So either fidelitypress.org or culturewars.com.
Thank you very much indeed. All of those links will be in the description, so people can just click straight through. I have to say, the Culture Wars magazine is the only magazine that I make time to read. My husband and I fight over it.
Good.
We only have two subscriptions, but Culture Wars is the one we fight over. So it's a fabulous, it really, really explains things in modern day contexts, which is so missing. I don't see that anyplace else from a Catholic perspective, contextualizing it in real time. So I find that extremely helpful. Thank you very much indeed for all of your work on there. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. E. Michael Jones of culturewars.com. All the links will be in the description. Go buy his books. I'm currently reading Logos Rising, and it is a masterpiece. And I cannot wait for our next discussion. Dr. Jones, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Take back your individual sovereignty and that of your family. Visit sarahplumley.substack.com and subscribe for free to stay up to speed with all things education, not indoctrination.